Redolence is the name of our sermon this morning. If you take out your outlines and open your Bibles to Revelation chapter 2, redolence means an aroma. Redolence is the kind of aroma that you smell during the holiday season. Perhaps you experienced a redolence type of moment when you walked into your house on Thanksgiving. And you smell the smells that are familiar. When I walk into my house, I smell the Christmas tree that is in our living room. And my eyes kind of close as I waft in that smell. It's apple pie a la mode on a cold day. It's the smell of turkey that comes from the kitchen. It's the smell of baking that comes from the kitchen. That I was just thinking about fudge. I bake a lot of, I don't know if it's really baking. I make a lot of fudge during the Christmas season. And when we open the refrigerator, out wafts the smell of fudge from the fridge. It's just like, oh, I'm getting fat just sniffing, you know? It's awesome. That is redolence. It is something that is aromatic. It is something that is so powerful in its smell that it reminds you of warmth and security and feeling good. Now, you guys are like all cozy and hungry. And if you're a guest, by the way, we're having fudge in my house tonight. And so you should come. Just for the fudge, because I know I'll be eating it. So, last week we looked at the first church of the apocalypse in the book of Revelation. You'll remember there in Revelation chapter 2, verse 1, we saw a message to the church at Ephesus. And today we are looking at a message to the church in Smyrna. Smyrna is the name of this church. And let me show you on a map where Smyrna is. That is not a map, but that is a map. Good. Okay. This is Ephesus right down here, port city, right on the out of the Caistor River. And here is Smyrna, also a port city. The route that we are taking is a big circular route that goes around like this. We are going to end up over here in Laodicea. We started in Ephesus. We are now in Smyrna. We're headed for Pergamum next time. But right now, we are at the church in Smyrna. And Smyrna is, incidentally, the only church that has a city in its location today. And here's a picture of that city. Deja vu. It was the first thing you showed. Anthony, that's you. Oh, good, good. Okay. This is a picture of this is not a picture of Smyrna from the first century. This is actually a picture of Smyrna today. High rises, a real big place. But there are spots in Smyrna. Anthony, give me that other picture. Like this is the area that was the Acropolis. It was the amphitheater that was in the center of old Smyrna. And this area right here is where many, many Christians were brought to trial. It was right here in this location. And you can see the city. I mean, can you imagine? That's a parking garage right there. And then right next to it are ruins. We just don't have this in California, you know? We don't have this kind of thing where you've got the ruins of an ancient city sitting right next to, you know, where you go to work and a parking garage and that kind of thing. But Because there is a modern city, Smyrna is the least excavated of all of the seven churches of the apocalypse. It's probably the one that we know the least amount about historically, archaeologically, because there is a city literally built on top of the areas where the old city would have been. And so we have a few ruins like this one, but we don't have as many as we do in some of the other locations. I'll show you some cool pictures of the other cities in weeks ahead. But this one we've only got a few of. And it is notable that we have this Acropolis area right here simply because of the context that we're about to talk about. So if you've got your outlines, you're going to want to look down at number one, letter A. The city of Smyrna, which I call the rock. I'm going to contrast that against the church in Smyrna, which is, the local Jews in Smyrna, number two, which is a hard place. So this is the rock and the hard place, and the church is, of course, caught in between a rock and a hard place. So here we go. Smyrna, the city, was passionately devoted to worshiping the emperor. In other words, they would worship Caesar, who was in Rome. Rome controlled the entire area, and they would worship the Caesar that was in Rome, believing that they were the most devoted city in all of Asia. If you remember that map and all those churches, they believed that they were most devoted to emperor worship, and that their devotion to emperor worship would give them favor in the sight of Rome. It would relieve some of the military pressure that many of the cities in the area felt, believing that they were the supreme city that was devoted to emperor worship. They had a city logo which everyone knew, which was first in all of Asia. That was what they named their city. Smyrna, first in all of Asia. That first was referring to the emperor worship. I looked up online what the city of Long Beach's logo is. Now, I don't know how long you've lived in Long Beach, but mysteriously enough, the city of Long Beach doesn't really have a logo. A lot of cities do have logos and little sayings that go, you know, like Long Beach, a great place to live, you know, that kind of thing. Apparently, Long Beach doesn't have anything like that. However, Beverly O'Neill, our mayor, has kind of coined this phrase throughout all the different things that she speaks on and writes about. She says that Long Beach is a city that has a future of promise. A future of promise, evidently referring to a past of something that wasn't so promising. A future of promise. So, see, cities kind of like to gather around a little saying, you know, Long Beach, we have a future of promise. Smyrna, we're first in all of Asia. We're first in all of the cities. They wanted to be known as being number one when it came to emperor worship. This is what kind of dictated the tone in all of the city. You can imagine what it must have been like for the Christians in Smyrna. There was so much adoration for Caesar in Smyrna that they didn't have just one temple built to Caesar. They had multiple temples and smaller shrines scattered throughout the city. Further, the primary form of worship to the emperor, letter C, top of the next page, was paying a cult tax. In other words, Rome was most concerned about taxes. That was their primary concern. They wanted money from all of these cities that they controlled. They had accomplished fantastic, far-reaching military campaigns, the likes of which have really never been seen by the world ever since. When it comes to the amount of money and resource that was devoted to the military campaign of expanding the Roman Empire. And when the Roman Empire was at its just maximum amount of power, they would collect taxes from all of the cities that were within their influence, which was a humongous, I've shown it to you before, a sprawling area that extended thousands of miles, which was remarkable in that day and age, that they militarily controlled that kind of space. Well, in Smyrna, you had to, as a citizen of Smyrna, you had to go to one of these cult temples and you had to pay a regular temple tax. And you did it as an act of worship to Caesar. Well, you can see where the disconnect would be for a Christian. You can understand where is if today you were told by the government of the United States that you had to go and pay a tax, not because you're a citizen of the United States, but out of worship to George W. Bush, you would be concerned that that might run opposite of your commitment to Jesus Christ. That was the situation that was occurring in Smyrna. In fact, they had multiple ways that you could worship Caesar. They even had the opportunity to burn incense. You could buy a little stick of incense and stick it in an incense burner and light it, and that would only cost you maybe $10 or $15, far more than the incense burning cost, the actual physical stick cost. It was an act of worship. You were spending more than it really was in order to support the cult worship of Caesar. There was also drinking wine, wine that had come from Caesar's kingdom, so to speak, and it was sent to Smyrna, and you could drink a little bit of Caesar wine, and you had to pay a high price for it, though. So they made cheap wine, and they sold it to the Smyrnian people for a great expense, and it was a way of worshiping Caesar. So this went on, and everyone was required to do it unless you were exempted by the Roman Senate. Look at letter D. The Jews in Smyrna were exempt from having to pay the cult tax or participate in any cult worship. Isn't that great? The Jews were totally exempt from having to do it. Why? Because Judaism was recognized as, and I throw together some big words here, pre-existent ancient monotheistic religion. I'm going to break that down. Pre-existent. It pre-existed the Roman Empire. It pre-existed the system of the Caesars. It pre-existed Rome's conquering of the known world. So that was an important caveat. If there was a religion that pre-existed Rome, the Roman Senate would consider whether or not that religion would be sanctioned by Rome. And if it was sanctioned by Rome, then you would be exempt from having to do any kind of emperor worship. Well, there are more caveats. It had to be ancient. In other words, it couldn't pre-exist Rome by like 10 years. It had to pre-exist, you know, way back, as far back as people understood. And of course, Judaism covers that. It also had to be monotheistic. In other words, you couldn't worship the Roman emperor because your religion was monotheistic. You only believed in worshiping one God. Well, of course, that is written right into the Ten Commandments that Jews can only have one God. Rome, understanding that it was a pre-existent ancient monotheistic religion, exempted the Jews from having to participate in any kind of cult worship. Well, this was a hugely advantageous position for the Jews. And as it turned out, it was a hugely advantageous place for the Christians. See, the Romans didn't understand what the difference was between people that followed Jesus and people that were Jews. They didn't know that there was any distinction. They just thought they're all Jews. Some of them are kind of a different little sect or a different little division within Judaism. But essentially, these are all Jews. And so Christians, for the first 50, 60, 70 years of Christianity, enjoyed protection from Rome because they identified with Judaism. Now this, as I point out down here in number 2, letter B, was a huge advantage for the Christians because it protected them from cult taxation, which was a financial advantage. It cost money to be involved in emperor worship, and the Christians were exempt from it. It helped exempt them from cult and idol worship, which gave them religious purity, because obviously the Christians believed in all of the Old Testament. And so when it says to worship only one God, Christianity embraces that also. And so it exempted them from any kind of cult or idol worship. And it also allowed for them to have unique and special relationships with their Jewish friends, which is where most of the converts initially were coming from. Contrary to popular belief, most of the early converts did not come from the Gentile nations. They came from Jews. Jews who understood the Old Testament, who understood the teachings about the Messiah, and when they were confronted with the person of Jesus Christ, embraced Him as such. They embraced Him as the Messiah that had come. And so they were able to have good relationships with Jews as they were sharing about Jesus Christ with them. However, over time, this began to break down. Unfortunately for Christians, there was an increasing distinction which was being emphasized by Jewish leaders throughout Asia Minor, which distinguished Judaism from Christianity, and it removed Christians from protection from all those things I listed in letter B, and I kind of try to summarize at the top of the next page. It exempted him from cult taxation, protection from emperor worship in pagan temples, and from social and business rejection from Jewish associates, friends, and even relatives. It was not unusual, in other words, for a son or a daughter to have converted to Christianity and have a Jewish set of parents. It was not unusual for a Christian carpenter, let's say, to work within a larger carpentry business where the owner was a Jew, since they were considered by Rome to be associated with one another. There was a lot of relational connection that occurred within Christianity and Judaism. But that began to break apart around 70, 80, 90 AD, after the death of Jesus Christ. That began to splinter, and most of it was initiated by the Jewish leaders. Now, that was not a hostile thing. I know it's easy sometimes to read the pages of Scripture and just think, oh, the Jews hated Christians. That wasn't necessarily the case. You'll remember that in the book of Acts, the Christians who were gathered together had to make a distinction on something called the widow's list. The widow's list was a list of people that were going to be supported by the church, and so many people wanted to get onto that list because they figured, hey, it's a free ride, that the actual widows, the actual people that needed to be on the list, were getting shortchanged. And so the apostles got together and they said, here are the requirements. Here are the requirements. This is what it takes to be on the widow's list. You have to be over this age. You have to be kind of past marrying age. You can't remarry at that point. You have to have this. You have to have this. And there was a set of guidelines. In other words, when something beneficial is offered, there has to be distinction that is brought to it in order to make sure that that thing that is valuable is kept valuable. Well, the Jews had something that was highly valued. That was exemption from emperor worship. And so people were associating themselves with the Jews that had nothing to do with Judaism. So the Jews began to provide lists, membership lists, to the Roman authorities. And who was not on those membership lists? Christians. Because, see, the Jewish leaders understood the difference. It might have been lost on the Romans, but it wasn't lost on the Jewish leaders, the synagogue leaders, the priests. They understood what Jesus stood for. They knew that they had rejected him as the Messiah. And so they provided membership lists that had no Christians on them. Once the Romans caught on to this, suddenly there was a distinction drawn. Well, see, Christianity didn't pre-exist the Roman Empire. Christianity was not an ancient religion from the Roman perspective. Christianity was confusing on a monotheistic level because the Christians were talking about worshiping Jesus Christ as God. And they were talking about worshiping God of the Old Testament as God. And so it was confusing to the Romans. It didn't seem like monotheism. So when they would come to the Christians and say, we want you to add Caesar to your worship, well, we can't do that because we worship only one God. Well, wait, you worship God of the Old Testament, but you worship Jesus, who is a man and walked around in Jerusalem and in Nazareth. That sounds like more than one to us. And the Christians began to come under persecution because people did not understand what Christianity was all about. It was brand new. It wasn't like they had thousands of years behind them like you and I enjoy today. This resulted in severe, severe persecution of the Christians, and it was most pronounced in an area right there in Smyrna because they were so politically passionate about supporting the emperor. So they were the first place out of the area that we're talking about in Asia Minor, to really go after Christians, to really separate them as a group from the Jews and say, this group here need to bow their knee to Caesar. So when we pick up in the text in Revelation chapter 2, verse 8, when it says to the angel or to the leadership of the church in Smyrna, write, the first and the last. Now, immediately when you read that, you're thinking of Jesus Christ. Of course, Jesus Christ is talking. This is a reflection of what was said about Him in chapter 1. But when you hear that, when it says to the church in Smyrna, from Jesus Christ, who was what? The first and the last. What was the name in the church in Smyrna? We are the first, right? In all of Asia. Jesus Christ steps in and says, nah, I'm the first. And furthermore, I'm the last. Just to clarify, you call your city the first, but Jesus Christ steps in and says, I am the first and the last. And to a city that was facing persecution, He says this, who was dead and has come to life. That would have been a tremendous encouragement to the Christians who are in Smyrna that were facing the opposition of the Romans, that were facing the opposition of the Jews. They were literally caught between a rock and a hard place. And they were trying to eke out worship to Jesus Christ in the middle of it all. Jesus Christ affirms His supremacy over all things, and He emphasizes His victory over death. He is the one that is the author of this short little letter to the church in Smyrna. The first thing Jesus Christ does is He recognizes their tribulation and poverty. Take a look at verse 9. I know your tribulation and your poverty. And then there's a little parenthesis that in your Bible. And it says, but you are rich. Let's unpack that just a little bit. This was a counterculture perspective. And it's one that is almost completely lost on American Christians. You have faced tribulation and you have faced poverty. In fact, in the text, the two phrases are connected. It's almost as though their tribulation has caused their poverty. In other words, what you are facing is causing you poverty. It's as though it's illuminating that because you are facing tribulation in the city of Smyrna, it's costing you financially. The relationships that you have enjoyed before are going away. And because of that, those of you that have worked for a Jewish owner of a business and what, those things are being cut off. Those of you that enjoyed exemption from tax, those things are being cut off. Those of you that will not participate in this emperor worship, you are losing your ability to make money. You are losing your ability to function in the city of Smyrna. You are under tribulation. You are being persecuted. It is causing poverty in your midst. And then Jesus Christ says, but you are rich. You can't help but think back to Philippians chapter 3, where it says, those that are persecuted, those that face opposition for the sake of Jesus Christ, are sharing in His sufferings. They are identifying with Jesus Christ. They are sacrificing because of their relationship with Him. Do you ever face this? I was thinking a lot about persecution this last couple of weeks as I've been reading this. What does it mean for American Christians to have fellowship in His sufferings? Remember, we are called to that. That is considered in the Bible one of the highest levels of imitating Jesus Christ that could possibly be, is to share so much in the identity of Jesus Christ that you are actually sharing in His suffering. That the rejection that people have of the name of Jesus Christ, when it identifies itself in His followers so completely that they share in His sufferings, it is considered the greatest blessing. The early church considered martyrdom, dying for faith in Jesus Christ, to be the highest calling, the number one thing. It wasn't being a pastor, wasn't being a Christian, it wasn't doing anything. It was dying for following Jesus Christ. One of the early church fathers wrote a letter to a fellow Christian, and he said, bring it on. Bring on broken bones, bring on lacerations, bring on clubs that will strike me on the head. Bring on every kind of violence and every kind of persecution. As long as it is for the sake of Jesus Christ, I will celebrate. and sharing in His sufferings. I so much want to identify with Him. I was talking to my wife and I said, you know what? And actually, this was spurred on by a professor at the school that I go to. He made the comment that he has never known anyone in all of his life in the United States of America that has ever had to die for their faith in Jesus. He's never known a single person. Now, maybe you do. No doubt you do. No doubt I will get an email this week telling me about somebody that died for Jesus in this country. And I don't mean a Christian that died, you know, in a violent act that knew Jesus, okay? I'm not talking about like, you know, what was that? Cassie and Columbine. Yeah. All right. She was a Christian and she got shot, but they shot a lot of other people. They weren't just running around shooting Christians. They were shooting lots of people. Everyone they disagreed with. I'm talking about people that are singled out and you know, plucked out of society by the government because they're and killed for it. The way they do in China. The way they do around the world, but not here in this country. And I thought about it. I talked to my wife about this. I've never known anyone that has died for their faith in this country. Ever. And I've been pretty thick in this whole church thing these last, you know, 30, 35 years. I know a lot of people. I travel around. I know a lot of Christians, a lot of places, go to a lot of conferences. Don't know anyone that has died for their Christianity in the United States of America. So when Jesus Christ says in verse 10 that some of you are going to suffer and be cast into prison, and then he says down there towards the end of verse 10, be faithful unto death. I am 100% convinced we don't get it. We just don't get it. We don't live in a place where that kind of persecution exists. Now, I have visited places. I've gone on short-term missions trips to places where that kind of persecution exists. Some of you in this room have ministered in those locations in this world. I have a friend that has spent a significant amount of time in China where there is a whole movement of the underground church, of the non-registered, evangelical, Christian, radical church where they meet and worship Jesus Christ. And they have to hide their movements from the government because they, if they are caught, they will be persecuted, beaten. Some of them to the point of death. We don't get it, do we? We don't live in the United States in that kind of a world. We are the richest and most influential country that has ever been on the face of the earth. And we don't have people that die in this country for Jesus Christ. And it could skew, it could tweak, it could bend our perspective. We could actually think to ourselves, we are blessed. We are blessed to not face persecution. We are blessed to not have to die for our faith. This is God's blessing on the United States of America. I could go for the rest of the day on why I don't think that's true. Why I think that great theology and real faith are probably more tested and more complete and more people have a more real life faith in countries where they'll die for what they believe than in the United States of America, where literally you can come to church and it doesn't even matter if you believe in Jesus Christ. You can float in, float out, act like a Christian, nobody would ever know. You do that in China and you're risking your life. You generally aren't going to do that unless you really believe that Jesus Christ came to save you from eternal death in hell. If you don't believe that, you're probably not going to go risking your life to go to the underground church. But in the United States, it doesn't translate that way for us. So what does it mean? What does it mean to us here? Here's what I think it means. I have a friend who's a school teacher who was asked by the principal, to throw a, you know, a seasonal party. It's the Christmas season, right? That's what this teacher was thinking. So they threw a Christmas party. They sent out cards to all the other teachers and all the other classrooms. It says, come on, everybody. The whole staff is invited to a Christmas party. This is in the public school system, mind you. Principal calls this teacher into his office and says, hey, I've gotten some objections. A lot of objections from teachers. They object to you using the word Christmas in your invitation. You know, it has Christ in there. They feel like that's inappropriate. I need you to make a public apology at the party for using that name. What would you do? That is happening all over the place. Little girl goes to school and wants to, teacher sends home an assignment and says, everybody, come back to school with something that you want to share with the class about this holiday season. Little girl comes back like other people in her class and says, I want to share the Christmas story. I want to sing a Christmas song. Teacher doesn't let her because we don't do anything religious. Rather, lumps her in with a friend and they sing a song about a dreidel, which is a Jewish toy used during the Hanukkah season. You know, it gets a little confusing, right? So the parent, and this was all told to me, the parent goes to the teacher and just to make sure, you know, just to clarify for the sake of the child, goes to make sure that this wasn't some sort of rejection that occurred because of Christianity, and just clarifies with the teacher, you know, when you redirected our daughter, what was that all about? Well, we prefer not to do anything that is religious during this season. We're trying to not offend anyone. What do you do as the parent? What do you do in that situation? I read an article this last week, actually a few weeks ago, that I cut out about a father who objected to his third grade son being in a class where sex education was being taught from a secular perspective. They were teaching kids about birth control and abortion. Third grader, okay? This is back east. And the father inserted himself into the situation and said, I don't want my child being taught that kind of material. I want my child being taught all sides of the perspective, and I want my child being taught that the right way to go about this is to have a monogamous relationship with the person that you're married to, and that out of that marriage relationship, God is going to honor my son in the greatest possible fashion that he could experience in a marriage. And the principal of the school went on record to say, if you're going to send your kid to the public school, then you need to let him teach what we want to teach. You need to let us teach him what we want to teach him. This isn't parent choice. This is participating in the public school system. And that father has raised an enormous stink, saying that is not what we signed up for. That is not what our tax dollars are going towards. You hear about it all the time. Public displays. The ACLU suing. And I'm not a big fan of the ACLU, but I'm not as hostile as you might think about them either. Public displays, though, of the nativity on the corner set up by the city being objected to. Lawsuits over the Ten Commandments. Over In God We Trust on our money. Over the Pledge of Allegiance. I read an article this last week written by a columnist at Chapman University. Attitudes about sex amongst college students. About one-night stands. How difficult is it in our society to stand up in the midst of a culture that is totally opposed to what Scripture says about the marriage bed being kept pure? Whether you are 13 years old or you are single and 35 years old, attitudes about sex in the Bible run totally counter to this culture. What about, you can tell I got off on writing about some of these things. Hey, business associates who are associated with godless endeavors, investing in companies who are clearly anti-Christian. And I don't mean non-Christian companies. I'm talking about anti-Christian companies. Companies that are supporting things that are against the purposes of Christianity. Is that where your investment, your retirement dollars are going? What do you do? What do you do when you are contributing money towards the persecution of Jesus Christ? What do you do when the investment dollars that you are investing are contributing to major corporations that support abortion? Something that I believe the Bible is vehemently against. What do you do? See, we don't experience persecution on the level of someone's going to hold a gun to your head and unless you deny Christ, you're going to get shot. We die slowly. We are like a frog in the kettle. You know the old story? If you throw a frog into boiling water, what does he do? He jumps right out. He's not stupid. It's boiling. But if you put him in cool water and he stays in it, and then you turn up the heat slowly, he'll boil to death, never noticing that the heat's being turned up. That's the kind of society we live in. The persecution is subtle. It's almost imperceptible. How do we do what is right, even when what is wrong is condoned, celebrated, and encouraged? How can we be people that know when the right moment is to face persecution for the sake of Jesus Christ? And really, that's the question, isn't it? So what do we do, Chris? Because I could insert myself into any situation. I could perceive persecution from so many different angles. What do I do? Do I become some kind of crazy, you know, Christ and Christ alone island, and I only buy Christian toothpaste, and I only buy, you know, Christian hairbrushes, and I've seen that kind of thing. We even get a thing here, the Christian Yellow Pages, you know, to where you only have to participate with other Christians. And I can't see how that's possibly consistent with be in the world but not of the world. So what do we do? I think in every one of these situations, there is a choice. There is a choice for us to make. There's a choice about whether to speak or stay silent. There's an opportunity to stand for Jesus Christ or to stay quiet about Jesus Christ. You know, I can remember even when I was in high school sitting next to a friend that said something that was opposite or anti-Christian. It was opposite of what I knew Jesus Christ to really be. And I had a choice at that moment to say something or to be silent. But I knew that if I said something, if I stood up for Jesus Christ, what was going to happen? I was going to be ridiculed. I was going to be put down. It could damage my friendships. It could affect the comfort of my life. And it is no different today. It's no different with your neighbors. It's no different with your children. It's no different in the world that we live in. There are moments that all of us have that are just like the Smyrnian church where Jesus Christ says, I know your tribulation. Jesus Christ is speaking those words to us. I know what you are going through. I know your difficulty. I know your poverty, whether it be of soul or of pocketbook. Jesus Christ knows our poverty and insists that we are rich. Why? Because we have the opportunity here to share in His sufferings. He goes on to say, the blasphemy by those who say they are Jews and are not, but are a synagogue of Satan. In other words, there were people out there that were identifying with the Jews that didn't believe in God, that didn't believe in Jesus, that didn't believe in anybody. But they were associating themselves with the Jews and they were not being persecuted. There's a whole group in there. The Christians want to kind of scream out, hey, wait, what about them? And Jesus Christ says, I see them. And with almost that sick feeling in the pit of your stomach, read with me through verse 10. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Does that have a sense of foreboding for you? It should. By the way, I'm on number 4, letter A. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. That do not fear, by the way, is placed emphatically in the sentence. It could be translated, don't give in. Don't be afraid of anyone. Stand firm. It should have an exclamation point in there somewhere. It's placed in an emphatic position. Do not fear what you are about to suffer. Behold, the devil is about to cast some of you into prison. It's not Rome. It's not the Jews. It's the devil that's trying to undo the church. You ever taken that perspective when you think about the problems the church has? It's not the person you disagree with. It's not the situation that you're aware of. It's the devil that is trying to undo the church. The devil's about to cast some of you into prison so that you will be tested. You'll have tribulation for 10 days. That might have been a literal period for the Smyrnian church. It's simply to say that that tribulation was for a short period of time, but an intense period of time. Look at how it's going to end up. Be faithful, he tells the ones that are going into prison, until death. My wife, as we were talking about this, asked me, who's he telling to be faithful there? And both. Imagine if someone you loved was thrown in jail, your wife or your husband. And you know from this that they're going to die. Who's it worse for? The one in jail or the one out? That's pretty tough. The persecution exists in both places, doesn't it? It's brutal on the family. It's brutal on the one being persecuted. And Jesus Christ tells him, be faithful. Be faithful until death. And I will give you the crown of life. I will give you the reward of life. Remember how he identified himself at the beginning of the verse? The one who was dead and has come to life. The one who's conquered death. You have nothing to fear, Jesus Christ says. And then in a common phrase in these letters that you'll see throughout, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes will not be hurt by the second death. A clear reference to hell. That's explained later on in the book in chapter 20, verse 14, 6, and in chapter 21, 8. It's a clear reference to eternal death and hell, the lake of fire, the place that was prepared for Satan and all of Satan's angels. Not for humanity. It was prepared for Satan. But part of the judgment clearly in the Bible is that those that will not follow Jesus Christ, that's where they're going to end up to. Persecution. I believe that you and I have choices that we make every day. Little choices, maybe even big choices in some situations. Choices of whether or not you will speak up about your relationship with Jesus Christ or be silent and say nothing. Jesus Christ is calling on you through this passage to speak up. Jesus Christ is calling on you in this passage to stand firm. Jesus Christ is calling on you to not fear anyone, but to be so deeply in love with Him that you would be willing to go through anything to identify who you are with the person of Jesus Christ. The church of Ephesus last week had lost their first love. And Jesus Christ invites them back into a love relationship. The church in Smyrna faced deep persecution. And Jesus Christ says to them, don't try to vindicate yourself. Stand for the name of Christ. Do not fear anyone. I will make sure that you get the victory in the end. Do you believe that? Do you believe that at work? Do you believe that in your family? Do you believe that at school? With a boyfriend or a girlfriend, do you believe it with a husband or a wife? Do you believe that Jesus Christ is truly the one that will vindicate His name? Will you stand up, maybe for the first time this week, for Jesus Christ? Will you speak His name in a place where you've never spoken it before, out of fear of what might happen? Not foolishly, but because the challenge is thrown out there and you know it. We've all been there. We know it in our heart. We sit there and we go, this is it. This is it right now. I'm supposed to say something. At that moment, Jesus Christ is calling on you to not be afraid of anything, but to throw yourself on His mercies. As the worship team comes, and as we sing, I want this to be a time where we really pray about practical situations. Some of you face real persecution. When I was a teenager, I faced it from my father, who would mock my faith. As an adult, I face it, to be honest with you, I face it on a consistent basis. Not only in the public school system that our daughters are involved with and that we try to interact with in a Christian manner, and that my wife, honestly, is on the front lines of on a regular basis. But I'll tell you, you would not believe the conversations I get in over at Starbucks. I know that sounds crazy. I know it's like, come on, Chris, how could that be? This, the same way it is for all of us. People say things, they make comments, they talk about life. And when they do, there are moments, not all of them, but there are moments where I know, Jesus Christ, You want me to respond. You want me to open my mouth and You want me to speak the truth. And I'm scared to death. What are You going to do? Jesus Christ wants our relationship with Him to be more important than fearing any other thing. Will you pray about that? Will you respond to that in this song? Will you throw yourself on His mercies? He's invited you to love Him last week. He invites you to stand with Him firmly this week. Let's worship together.